So my name, thanks for the opportunity to come. My name is Mark Dirksen, and I'm a regional minister for the Canadian Baptists of Western Canada. Our denomination includes churches from Manitoba all the way to the Vancouver Island, and I look after about 40 or so churches in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and it's a privilege to do so. Before that, I was pastor at Willow Lake Baptist Church here in Winnipeg near the Mint in various capacities until 2014 when I took this role on. I grew up in southern Manitoba, and my wife Mary works for the Manitoba government. We have two children, both working and both are in university, and we have a Springer Doodle dog named Cash. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be with you this morning, and I haven't actually met your pastor, Dave, but we have connected through a brother of mine who is also in ministry. I trust Dave is having a good sabbatical, and since I work with pastors, I want to thank you as a congregation for your leadership for looking after Dave in this way. Thanks very much for doing so. I think we're going to do things a little differently today than maybe what how things normally roll. What I want to do is I want to begin by reading a chapter from Genesis chapter 4. And if you have your Bibles with you, please follow along with me. But as I preach, I'm going to ask that you keep your thumb between Genesis 3 and chapter 4, as we'll kind of talk about both of those chapters as we move along. Genesis chapter 4. I'm reading from the New Living Translation. Now, Adam had sexual relations with his wife, Eve, and she became pregnant. And when she gave birth to Cain, she said, "With the Lord's help, I have produced a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother and named him Abel. When they grew up, Abel became a shepherd, while Cain cultivated the ground. And when it was time for the harvest, Cain presented some of his crops as a gift to the Lord. Abel also brought a gift, the best of the firstborn lambs from his flock. The Lord accepted Abel and his gift, but he did not accept Cain and his gift. This made Cain very angry, and he looked dejected. "Why are you so angry?" the Lord asked Cain. "Why do you look so dejected? You will be accepted if you do what is right. But if you refuse to do what is right, then watch out. Sin is crouching at the door, eager to control you. But you must subdue it and be its master." One day, Cain suggested to his brother, "Let's go out into the fields." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother, Abel, and killed him. Afterward, the Lord asked Cain, "Where is your brother? Where is Abel?" "I don't know," Cain responded. "Am I my brother's guardian?" But the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen. Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are cursed and banished from the ground, which has swallowed your brother's blood. No longer will the ground yield good crops for you, no matter how hard you work. From now on, you will be a homeless wanderer on the earth." Cain replied to the Lord, "My punishment is too great for me to bear. You have banished me from the land and from your presence. You have made me a homeless wanderer. Anyone who finds me will kill me." The Lord replied, "No, for I will give a sevenfold punishment to anyone who kills you." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain to warn anyone who might try to kill him. So Cain left the Lord's presence and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain had sexual relations with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Then Cain founded a city, which he named Enoch after his son. Enoch had a son named Irad. Irad became the father of Mahujael. Mahujael became the father of Methuselah. Methuselah became the father of Lamech. Lamech was married two women. The first was named Adah, and the second was Zillah. Adah gave birth to Jabal, who was the first of those who raised livestock and live in tents. His brother's name was Jubal, the first of all who play the harp and the flute. And Lamech's other wife, Zillah, gave birth to a son named Tubal-Cain. He became an expert in forging tools of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain had a sister named Naamah. One day Lamech said to his wives, "Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. Listen to me, you wives of Lamech. I have killed a man who attacked me, a young man who wounded me. If someone who kills Cain is punished seven times, then the one who kills me will be punished 77 times. Adam had sexual relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to another son. She named him Seth, for she said, God has granted me another son in place of Abel, whom Cain killed. When Seth grew up, he had a son and named him Enosh. At that time, people first began to worship the Lord by name. The word of the Lord. Now, I don't know what your summer reading has been like, but I have had the chance to read some exciting material like commentary on Genesis by Tremper Longman and an Old Testament professor. And have you read Genesis lately? I mean, in rereading it, I found myself thinking on more than one occasion, man, that is weird, whatever they're doing over there. And I've also read some of Ian Proben's book entitled Seriously Dangerous Religion, which is also written by an Old Testament professor at Regent College in Vancouver. These sorts of books are interesting to me because they can't help but speak of the human condition from a biblical perspective. In the first 11 chapters alone, we have stories of betrayal, murder, corruption, big boats, God's broken heart, floods, drunkenness, curses, language confusion, and so forth. It's almost like the inspiration for Netflix in general. And I won't get into all of these things, but I do want to focus on the story of Cain and Abel today, making some observations, I hope, that will help us understand the biblical worldview just a little more and will help us to once again see God's grace and hopefulness in the midst of a pretty grim story. I'm a brother to 8 siblings, so I have some interest and genuine interest in the story, if you know what I mean. The backdrop to our narrative this morning is the wonderful creation story, the story of God bringing order out of chaos, and subsequently the description of original sin and the fall of humanity. We sung about chaos earlier this morning already. And, of course, there's more chaos, if you will. Moral innocence collapsed through rebellion, as described in chapter 3, and the main players in that story were Adam and Eve. Interestingly, once they transgress against God, they aren't all that willing to have God's presence with them and attempt to hide from him. And when God comes looking for them, he asks, "Where are you?" And if we're paying attention spiritually, we recognize that question ourselves in our own times of spiritual drought and drift. Excuses are offered and blame is allocated quickly thereafter. And if you're familiar with any human, including yourself, this story of the origin of rebellion and its continuing saga, these things don't really surprise you. In fact, it confirms it instead. And so we come to chapter 4, and I wish to make some observations from the text while drawing some connections to the account of the fall of humanity in Genesis 3. Our first section is verses 1 to 9, Cain's murder of Abel. And you may remember from Genesis 3 that a curse had been placed on the man and the woman. The woman was cursed with increased pain in pregnancy, and I can only imagine the concerns that Eve must have had as she bore the first baby known to humankind. We now have lots of information on the length of pregnancies, on what to expect when you're expecting, and so forth, but Eve was the first to experience pregnancy without much idea about what was going on. And so, suitably, Eve was excited to give birth to a baby and rightfully ascribed praise to God for the safe arrival of their first child. It is also significant to note that this was a sign of God's blessing after those curses in Genesis chapter 3. The child was born to Adam and Eve, even though it must have been a time of uncertainty for them, perhaps not understanding the full implications of their actions in the garden. Adam and Eve named their first child Cain, which means brought forth. Not long after, Abel is born to them, and his name means vapor or meaninglessness, the same word that the writer of Ecclesiastes uses throughout his book to describe his view of reality. Meaningless, meaningless, everything's meaningless. So as the boys grew, they took on different occupations. Cain chose to farm, and Abel was a shepherd, and when they were old enough, they presented some of the results of their labor to God at harvest time, which is a long-standing practice, it sounds like. Cain brought fruit and vegetables, and Abel brought the best of the firstborn lambs from the flock. Curiously, the Lord accepted Abel and his gift, but he rejected Cain and his gift. Many folks have tried to figure out why God accepted one and not the other, but there isn't actually too much from the text that offers much perspective on this. Perhaps there's one clue that might be that Cain brought his ordinary vegetation while Abel brought his very best of animals. Probably the point of the story is not so much about a comparison between these sacrifices, but maybe about Cain's response to his brother and to God. So it would seem that the details about the offerings are maybe a background consideration. It's also interesting to note here that God is the one who ultimately chooses to respond and is free to do so. God says, "I prefer that one." Even though the response seems a bit unfair. I mean, how was Cain to know exactly? And even more perplexing, maybe, the trouble in this story arises because God's the one who makes the choice between the two. Now, we don't get much information about Abel's response to having God respond favorably to him and his offering, so there is no evidence that Abel was pompous about this development or trash-talked Cain, saying something to the effect of the modern day, "in your face." What is important to the narrator is that Cain's response is immediately negative. He doesn't want to try again. He doesn't want to straighten things out. He doesn't want to get things better. But the text tells us that he was angry and dejected. That's it. We might say that he was depressed. And I find it compassionate in verse 6 that God does not dismiss Cain because of those feelings. In fact, God pursues Cain and asks him some questions before making a comment about reality. "Why are you so angry?" God asks. And further, "Why do you look so dejected?" God cares about Cain in those moments, and he cares about us when we're in those moments as well. Interestingly, right after God checks in on Cain with those questions, he offers Cain an encouragement and also a warning. He encourages him to do the right thing. And given the narrative from Genesis 3, this is still a real surprise. It's still possible for Cain to do the right thing as he lived life outside the garden. And once God says that, he also gives Cain a warning. If you refuse to do what is right, sin is crouching at your door, eager to control you. You must subdue it and be its master. The New International Version translates this a little differently, and perhaps it gives us an allusion that's a little more clear. It says, "Sin is crouching at your door, and it desires to have you, but you must master it." With this translation, perhaps it's easier for us to recognize that we've heard the word desire already in the creation story, and particularly in the fall story. In Genesis 3:16, as part of the curse on Eve, she is told that her desire will be for her husband, and he will rule over you. Clearly, there is no connotation of sexual desire in Genesis 3 and here in Genesis 4. Instead, the underlying current to the use of this word is the notion of control or consumption. Cain is warned that sin is a personified entity here, depicted as crouching at a doorway, ready to pounce on him and control him, much like a lion is ready to pounce. And if we see sin as a choice from the Adam and Eve story, here we see that sin is also something else. It's also an aggressive force. It's a dire picture, I think, to be sure. Yet even this dire description of sin is not without hope. As we notice the last part of verse 7, we see that Cain must choose how to respond to this force of sin in his life. God tells him, even after expulsion of the first family from the garden, that sin can be subdued and it can be mastered. The force of sin need not have its way in Cain's life, and the possibility for things to go differently is certainly in front of him. Tragically, Cain does not heed God's direction for his life, and in a short sentence that reduces extreme violence to just a few words, we see the resolution to Cain's situation for the time being. He does not rule over the force of sin in his life, but instead is ruled by it as he lures his brother to the fields and then kills him. This is the first murder recorded in the scriptures, and it is a remarkably sad tale. You'd think that the first family would have seen better relationships, maybe first between Adam and Eve, and now here between the brothers as first siblings. But the Bible is not a sanitized version of human history or of human condition. And we see here again that relationships amongst families and siblings are not outside the purview of failure and violence. The force of sin is not restrained somehow from even our closest relationships. As we head to the next section of the story, from verses 10 to 16, we see curses announced and expulsion yet again. And we see a lot of similarity with the end of chapter 3. The Lord even asks very similar questions, and instead of asking Adam where he was after Adam went hiding, he asks Cain, "Where is your brother? Where is Abel?" And like his father before him, Cain tries some evasive tactics, and he lies in order to avoid the pointedness of the question. Of course, Cain knows where Abel is. He knows full well. But then he tries to abdicate all responsibility by saying, "Am I my brother's guardian?" In other translations, the meaning is a bit clearer. In the New International Version, for instance, the translation goes, "Am I my brother's keeper?" In Genesis, the answer is not given directly because it does not need to be. One author writes that from the perspective of biblical faith, the obvious answer is yes. Yes, if you have been created to work the garden and to care for it, literally to keep it, you are certainly also to keep your brother and to care for him. This word "to keep" appears elsewhere, and when it is used, it often describes God's care for his people. In Psalm 121, we read, "The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life." And in the benediction, we often hear from number 6, "The Lord bless you and keep you." Cain failed at this, of course, and the contrast between his understanding of keeping the other with God's keeping of his people, I think, is striking. Following this, God pronounces a curse on Cain. Whereas in Genesis 3, the curse was upon the ground, here we see further banishment in that Cain was banished from the ground which he tilled and sent off to be a homeless wanderer. Now, I don't know about you, but given the rest of the Old Testament witness, I would have expected death for Cain at this juncture. Cain, however, doesn't quite get the notion that he has offended God and abdicated his responsibility, and responds with another self-centered response and self-centered concern. "This punishment is far too great for me," he says, concerned again that no one else except himself. He's worried that he might meet the same fate as his brother, though this time at the hands of a complete stranger. And God's response here in this story, this early story from the scriptures, illustrates and foreshadows a glimpse, maybe, of how God deals with his people. Yes, there is justice in this narrative, but there is also mercy. God is patient with Cain during this entire time, and he wants him to respond well and encourages him to do so. And ultimately, though, because of Cain's actions, he punishes him to a life even further away from the garden. In fact, even after Cain's crime, God shows concern and demonstrates grace. And instead of death, Cain is banished, yet is given a mark of some kind, a mark which denotes both a curse on Cain, but also his protection. As we continue in this passage from verses 17 to 24, we continue to see some interesting pieces about the ramifications of Cain's actions through his descendants. Cain, in his life after the garden, is able to have offspring and actually does not wander, but establishes a city instead. The establishment of a city might well be further rebellion by Cain, resisting the punishment against him. But Cain's descendants are also responsible for certain developments in civilization, according to Genesis. Nomadic herding is developed, music was developed, and the formation of metalworks all derive from Cain's descendants. And the point to these observations is not that cities, nomadic herding, music, and metalworks are irretrievably evil. No, these observations remind us that much good can come from these things, but they can also be used for great evil and harm as well, because they come from the line of Cain. One more observation about Cain's descendants, specifically Lamech in verses 23 and 24. Lamech is not a good guy. even though he would be the father of Noah. In fact, Lamech is the first polygamist that is reported in the scriptures, and sadly, he boasts about how violent he has been. He has been attacked by a young man, and he did not respond proportionately. In fact, his violence was grossly disproportionate and far exceeds the crime, as he killed the person who attacked him. And in his boasting, then, of his vengeful spirit, he shows no regard for other humans or any limit on violence, a sure sign that Cain's descendants are spiraling further and further away from God. He even wrote a poem about his vengeance. And the punishment of 77 times more excessive than the original transgression that he received. Cain's legacy was dark, and things were getting darker and more violent generation by generation, and Lamech is one of those poster boys for that particular truth. Now, if that were the end of the Genesis chapter 4, things would seem quite bleak indeed. Life after the garden was getting bleaker and bleaker, more violent, generation by generation, with no regard for the other. Yet, as we come to the last verses of Genesis 4, you might almost light a match in a dark room to get the sense of the verse here. Cain's descendants were spiraling away from God, to be sure, but back closer to the garden remained Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve had another son, and they named him Seth. Seth was a replacement for Abel, and interestingly, if you read the genealogy in Genesis chapter 5, our next chapter, you will not find Cain and Abel mentioned. The genealogy does illustrate the lineage of Seth, and later in Genesis, all the way to Abraham and beyond. The point is that God blesses his people and blesses his people so that they might in turn bless others. Well, if you followed me thus far in the midst of all the allusions and cross-references, I hope that you've come to see some of the richness of this particular narrative and its theological significance. I do want to highlight a few emphases as I bring our sermon time to a close. Let's begin by thinking more about the notion of sin as presented here. In our highly individualized society and time, it is easy to think that sin is pretty much about choosing between right and wrong action at a particular time. But here we are told that sin is a force, and it's an aggressive one at that. It seeks to control us, to devour us, and its goal is chaos, destruction. In other words, because we too suffer from the human condition and embody life outside of the garden, we must learn to be on guard against sin in our lives, no matter the form. Depravity runs deep in our experiences, yet the text also reminds us that we too can do good, and we do not need to succumb. God encouraged Cain to do so, and we do well to take that encouragement into our own lives. God encouraged Cain with phrases like, "Do what is right, subdue the sin, master it, instead of it mastering you." And if you're like me, this passage prompts us to look at our lives and to see if there are areas that we can make right. Maybe there's areas that we've got some cleanup to do and where we've been mastered for far too long now. And thankfully, in this life after the garden, we still have the opportunity to make things better. I'd also like to consider more the cultural development that is mentioned in the text. Not only are these cultural developments, but they are also, when we look at them, technological developments. The text mentions things like developments of cities, shepherding, music, metalworks. One of the points of the text that it is trying to make, as I mentioned earlier, that is that these developments are not neutral. Cities are great places, to be sure, but there's also a lot of harm that happens in cities. Music, too, can lead us toward God and holiness or away from God. And I don't think it helps to reduce music to Christian and non-Christian for this to be true. Similarly, metalworking can be used for good and for ill. Much engineering has happened to make the world a better place, for instance. But there are many atrocities that have happened because a weapon has been formed against another. And for us today, we are surrounded by technology, and it is to our detriment if we do not examine technology and its pros and cons before we actually use them, or maybe to have a refresher as we're using them. If we're astute, we ought not to say that, well, that's just the way it is, or that's the way that society is going, as we hum a Bruce Hornsby song in the background, while not evaluating the effects of technology in our own lives. Take, for instance, something as mainstream as the development of social media. Is this something that has the potential for both good and bad? Is the bad outweighing the good in your life at the moment? If the first thing you look at in the morning, your phone, is it time for some evaluation and perhaps some fasting at the least? And as a simple example, I've taken a sabbatical from Instagram this summer and do not regret doing so whatsoever. Sometimes I'm happier not knowing what other people are thinking. Third, I am absolutely encouraged by what it means to be a keeper from this passage. Essentially, this has to do with right relationships with other people, families, and neighbors included. It's the notion of being responsible, caring for others. We are image bearers. And as much as Cain tried to wiggle out of those responsibilities, we know that when things are functioning properly and we are relating to God and others properly, we will be serious about our ethical responsibilities towards our families and neighbors. We will keep them. And when we dig a little deeper and we act as God acted in this text, we will be generous and gracious to our neighbors even when they are leading dark lives. I know this last piece is tough to swallow, at least in my lived experience in my own neighborhood. Yet God calls me to it, and I'm sure you can think of situations in your own life where you too are called to do something as difficult as this. Finally, we end with God. God does a lot of remarkable things, and for today, I just want to highlight two. First, God treats Cain with justice and grace. And as I mentioned earlier, I fully expected Cain to be killed as a result of his actions, but he was not. Yet, yes, he was expelled from the garden, but he was also protected. And God's interactions with him were mainly for encouragement. Do the right thing, Cain. Master the sin at your doorstep. There is a way out of this mess yet. As one author writes, the good in this story and in the world comes from God, but the evil in it comes from God's creatures who turn away from what is good. Surely God could have ended the human experiment after the fall of humanity, but God chose not to. Surely he could have ended the human experiment with the flood, but God chose not to. He continues to find a way to bless his people so that they might bless others. God pursues us, encourages us to do the right thing, and treats us with justice and grace. Second, if we follow allusions to this story into the New Testament, we come to some of Jesus' teaching on forgiveness. In Matthew 18, Jesus reverses Lamech's vengeance and applies it to forgiveness instead. We are to forgive 70 times 7. Lamech poured out vengeance indiscriminately, but God through Jesus pours out forgiveness extravagantly and encourages his followers to do so too. We need this God and this approach for our lives as we encounter life after the garden, perhaps now more than ever. Amen.